The Hunter's Tale. Have you seen a Janta? Really seen a Janta? Bloody magnificent. In the same way that a hurricane or an exploding volcano is magnificent. Magnificent and appalling. The films can never capture the sense of scale. Imagine a house with fangs and tusks and spines. A house that can hit 40 miles per hour. The films can never get the sheer sense of mass and speed or the elegance and grace that something so huge can be so nimble, so agile. And what the films can never, ever capture is the smell. They smell of curry, Vindaloo curry, Venerian body chemistry. But that's why you never, ever eat curry on Azjan. Out in the Stalva, the grass is tall enough to hide even a Janta. The smell is the only warning you get. You catch a whiff of Vindaloo, you run. You always run. When you hunt Janta, there will always be a moment when it turns and the Janta hunts you. You run. If you're lucky, you draw it onto the gun line. If not, the thrones of Stalva have been hunting them for this way for centuries. Coming-of-age thing like my own Maasai people. They give you a spear and point you in the general direction of a lion. Yes, I've killed a lion. I've also killed Janta and run from even more. The Thones have a word for it, the Pnem, the fool who runs. That's how I met your brother. He applied to be a Pnem for ochering Azjans. Claimed experience over at Hundera Way with Costa's hunting company. I didn't need to call Costa to know he was a bullshitter, but I liked the fellow. He had charm and didn't take himself too seriously. I knew he'd never last 5 minutes as a Pnem. Took him on as a camp steward. They liked the personal service, the hunting types. If you can afford to fly yourself and your friends on a jolly to Venus, you expect to have someone to wipe your ass for you. Charm works on these bastards. He'd wheedle his way into their affections and get them drinking. They'd invite him, and before you knew it, he was getting their life stories and a lot more besides out of them. He was a careful cove, too. He'd always stay one drink behind them and be up early and sharp-eyed as a hawk the next morning. Bring them their bed tea, fluff up their pillows, always came back with the fattest tip. I knew what he was doing, but he did it so well. I'd taken him on, hadn't I? So, an aristocrat. Why am I not surprised? Within 3 trips, I'd made him maître de la chasse. Heard he'd made and lost 1 fortune already, is that true? A jewel thief? Why am I not surprised by that either? The 30th Earl of Mar fancied himself as a sporting type. Booked a 3-month grand Azjan, he and 5 friends, shooting their way up the great littoral to the Stalva. Wives, husbands, lovers, personal servants, 20 cent Azjanis, and a caravan of 40 grappa to carry their bags and baggage. They had 1 grap just for the champagne. They'd shipped every last drop of it from Earth. Made so much noise we cleared the forest for 10 miles around, bloody brutes. We'd set up hides at waterholes so they could blast away from point blank range. That's not hunting. Every day they'd sent 12 bearers back with hides and trophies. I'm surprised there was anything left. The amount of metal they'd pumped into those poor beasts. The stench of rot. God! The sky was black with carrion avios. Your brother excelled himself. Suave in control, charming, witty, the soul of attention. Oh, most attentive. Especially to the Lady Ma. She was no cack-hand with the guns, but I think she tired of the boys' club antics of the gents. Or maybe it was just the sheer relentless slaughter. Either way, she increasingly remained in camp where your brother attended to her. Aristocrats. They sniff each other out. So, Arthur polled the Lady Mar while we blasted our bloody, brutal, bestial way up onto the High Stalva. Nothing would do the 30th Earl but to go after Janta. 3 out of 5 Azjanis never even come across a Janta. 10% of hunters who go for Janta don't come back. Only 10%. He liked those odds. 25 sleeps we were up there while great day turned to great evening. I wasn't staying for night on the Stalva. It's not just a different season, it's a different world. Things come out of sleep, out of dens, out of ground. No, not for all the fortune of the Earls of Mar would I spend night on the Stalva. By then we'd abandoned the main camp. We carried bare rations, sleeping out beside our mounts with one ear tuned to the radio. Then the call came, Janta sign. And as Jani had seen a fresh path through a speargrass meadow 5 miles to the north of us, in a moment we were mounted and tearing through the high Stalva. The Earl rode like a madman, whipping his grap to reckless speed. Damn fool! Of all the Stalva's many grasslands, the tall pike grass meadows were the most dangerous. A Janta could be right next to you and you wouldn't see it. And the pike grass disorients, reflects sounds, turns you around. There was no advising the Earl of Mar and his chums, though. His wife hung back. She claimed her mount had picked up a little lameness. Why did I not say something when Arthur went back to accompany the Lady Mar? But my concern was how to get everyone out of the pike grass alive. Then the Earl stabbed his shock goad into the flank of his grap, and before I could do anything, he was off. My radio crackled. Form a gun line. The mad fool was going to run the Janta himself. Aristocrats. Your pardon, ma'am. Moments later, his grap came crashing back through the pike grass to find its herd mates. My only hope was to form a gun line and hope and pray that he would lead the Janta right into our crossfire. It takes a lot of ordnance to stop a Janta. And in this kind of tall grass terrain, where you can hardly see your hand in front of your face, I had to set the firing positions just right so the idiots wouldn't blow each other to bits. I got them into some semblance of position. I held the centre, the Laku. Your brother and the Lady Mar, I ordered to take Jeft and Garoon, the last two positions of the left wing of the gun line. Finally, I got them all to radio silence. The phones teach you how to be still and how to listen and how to know what is safe and what is death. Silence, then a sustained crashing. My spotter called me, but I did not need her to tell me. That was the sound of death. I could only hope that the Earl remembered to run in a straight line and not to trip over anything, and that the gun line would fire in time. 100 hopes, 100 ways to die. Most terrifying sound in the world. A Janta in full pursuit. It sounds like it's coming from everywhere at once. I yelled to the gun line, steady there, steady, hold your fire. Then I smelt it. Clear, sharp, unmistakable. Curry. I put up the cry, Vindaloo, Vindaloo. And there was the Mad Earl breaking out of the cane. Madman, what was he thinking? He was in the wrong place, headed in the wrong direction. The only ones who could cover him were Arthur and Lady Mar, and there behind him, the Janta, bigger than any I had ever seen, the mother of all Janta, the queen of the high Stalva. I froze. We all froze. We might as well try to kill a mountain. I yelled to Arthur and Lady Mar, shoot, shoot now. Nothing. Shoot for the love of all the stars. Nothing. Shoot. Why didn't they shoot? The Thones found the 30th Earl of Mar spread over 100 yards. They hadn't shot because they weren't there. They were at it like dogs. Your brother and the Lady Mar, back where they'd left the party. They hadn't even heard the Janta. Strange woman, the Lady Mar. Her face barely moved when she learned of her husband's terrible death. Like it was no surprise to her. Of course, she became immensely rich when the will went through. There was no question of your brother's ever working for me again. Shame, I liked him, but I can't help thinking that he was as much used as user in that sordid little affair. Did the Lady of Mar murder her husband? Too much left to chance. Yet it was a very convenient accident, and I can't help but think that the 30th Earl knew what his lady was up to, and a surfeit of cuckoldry drove him to prove he was a man. The Janta haunted the Highlands for years, became a legend. Every aristo idiot on the inner worlds who fancied himself a great terrene hunter went after it. None of them ever got it, though it claimed 5 more lives. The human slayer of the Selvar. In the end, it stumbled into a thone clutch trap and died on a punji stake, eaten away by gangrene. So we all pass. No final run, no gun line, no trophies. Your brother, as I said, I liked him, though I never trusted him. He left when the scandal broke, went up country, over the Stalva into the Palisade country. I heard a rumour he'd joined a mercenary Javrost unit, fighting up on the Altiplano. Botany, is it? Safer business and big game.
Plate 5, V. Trifex Aculeatum, Stanage's bird-eating triffid, native of the great littoral forest of Ishtaria. Carnivorous in its habits, it lures smaller nectar-feeding avios with its sweet exudate, then stings them to death with its whip-like style and sticky, poisoned stigma. Cut paper, inks, folded tissue. The princess is brushing her hair. This she does every night, whether in Tonga or Ireland, on Earth, or aboard a space crosser, or on Venus. The ritual is invariable. She kneels, unpins, and uncoils her tight bun and lets her hair fall to its natural length, which is to her waist. Then she takes 2 silver-backed brushes and, with great and vigorous strokes, brushes her hair from the crown of her head to the tips. 100 strokes, which she counts in a Tongan rhyme that I very much love to hear. When she's done, she cleans the brushes, returns them to the baize-lined case, then takes a bottle of coconut oil and works it through her hair. The air is suffused with the sweet smell of coconut. It reminds me so much of the whin flowers of home in the spring. She works patiently and painstakingly, and when she has finished, she rolls her hair back into its bun and pins it. A simple, dedicated, repetitive task, but it moves me almost to tears. A beautiful hair. How dearly I love my friend La Tufui. We are sleeping at a hovanda, a Thent roadside inn on the Grand North Road in Canton Hua in the great littoral forest. Tree branches scratch at my window shutters. The heat, the humidity, the animal noise are all overpowering. We are far from the cooling breezes of the Vestal Sea. I wilt, though La Tufui relishes the warmth. The arboreal creatures of this forest are deeper voiced than in Ireland. Bellings and honkings and deep booms. How I wish we could spend the night here. Great night. For my Carfax tells me that the Ishtarian littoral forest contains this world's greatest concentration of luminous creatures. Fungi, plants, animals, and those peculiarly Venerian phyla in between. It is almost as bright as day. I've made some daytime studies of the star flower. No Venerian botanica can be complete without it. But for it to succeed, I must hope that there is a supply of luminous paint at Laguza, where we embark for the crossing of the Stalva. My dear La Tufui has finished now and closed away her brushes in their green baize-lined box. So faithful and true a friend. We met in Nuku'alofa, on the Tongan leg of my botanica of the South Pacific. The king, her father, had issued the invitation. He was a keen collector. And at the reception I was introduced to his very large family, including La Tufui, and was immediately charmed by her sense, dignity, and vivacity. She invited me to tea the following day, a very grand affair, where she confessed that as a minor princess, her only hope of fulfillment was in marrying well. An institution in which she had no interest. I replied that I had visited the South Pacific as a time apart from Lord Rathangan. It had been clear for some years that he had no interest in me, nor I in him. We were two noble ladies of compatible needs and temperaments, and there and then we became firmest friends and inseparable companions. When Patrick shot himself and Rathangan passed into my possession, it was only natural that the princess move in with me. I cannot conceive of life without La Tufouille. Yet I am deeply ashamed that I have not been totally honest in my motivations for this Venerian expedition. Why can I not trust? Oh, secrets! Oh, simulations! V. Stelliflores noctecandentis, the Venerian starflower. Its name is the same in Thent, Thek, and Crid. Now a popular terrestrial garden plant, where it is known as glowberry, though the name is a misnomer. Its appearance is a bunch of night-luminous white berries, though the berries are in fact globular bracts, with a bioluminous flower at the centre. Selective strains of this flower traditionally provide illumination in Venerian settlements during the Great Night. Paper, luminous paint, not reproduced. The original paper cut is mildly radioactive. By high train to Camahoo. We have our own carriage. It is of aged Gothar wood, still fragrant and spicy. The hammocks do not suit me at all. Indeed, the whole train has a rocking, swaying lollop that makes me seasick. In the caravanserai at Lugasa, the contraption looked both ridiculous and impractical. But here, in the high grass, its ingenuity reveals itself. The 20-foot-high wheels carry us high above the grass. Though I am in fear of grass fires, the steam tractor at the head of the train does throw off the most ferocious pother of soot and embers. I am quite content to remain in my carriage and work on my Stalva grass study. I think this may be most sculptural. The swaying makes for many a slip with a scissor, but I think I've caught the feathery, almost downy nature of the flower heads. Of a maritime people, the princess is at home in this rolling ocean of grass and spends much of her time on the observation balcony, watching the patterns the wind draws across the grasslands. It was there that she fell into conversation with the Honourable Cormac de Butler, a fellow Irishman. Inevitably he ingratiated himself, and within minutes was taking tea in our carriage. The inner worlds are infested with young men claiming to be the junior sons of minor Irish gentry. But a few minutes' gentle questioning revealed not only that he was indeed the Honourable Cormac of the Bagnallstown de Butlers, but a relative close enough to know of my husband's demise and the scandal of the Blue Empress. Our conversation went like this. Himself. The Grange Gorman Hydes. My father used to knock around with your elder brother. What was he called? Myself. Richard. Himself. The younger brother. Wasn't he a bit of a black sheep? I remember there was this tremendous scandal. Some jewel? A sapphire as big as a thrush's egg? Yes, that was the expression they used in the papers. A thrush's egg. What was it called? Myself. The Blue Empress. Himself. Yes, that was it. Your grandfather was presented it by some Martian princess. Ha ha ha! Services rendered. Myself. He helped her escape across the Tharsis steppe in the Revolution of 11, then organized the White Brigades to help her regain the Jasper throne. Himself. Your brother, not the old boy. You woke up one morning to find the stone gone and him vanished. Stolen. I could see that the Princess La Tufouille found the Honourable Cormac's bluntness distressing. But if one claims the privileges of a noble family, one must also claim the shames. Myself. It was never proved that Arthur stole the Blue Empress. Himself. No, no, but you know how tongues wag in the country. And his disappearance was, you must admit, timely. How long ago was that now? God, I must have been a wee gossoon. Myself, 15 years. Himself, 15 years, and not a word. Do you know if he's even alive?
Myself, we believe he fled to the inner worlds. Every few years we hear of a sighting, but most of them are so contrary we dismiss them. He made his choice. As for the Blue Empress, broken up and sold long ago, I don't doubt. Himself.
And here I find you on a jaunt across one of the inner worlds?
Myself, I am creating a new album of paper cuts, The Botanic of Veneris.
Himself, oh, of course, if I may make so bold, Lady Rathangan. The Blue Empress, do you believe Arthur took it?
And I made him no verbal answer, but gave the smallest shake of my head.
Princess Latufui had been restless all this evening, the time before sleep, that is. Great evening was still many terrene days off. Can we ever truly adapt to the monstrous Venerian calendar? Arthur has been on this world for 15 years. Has he drifted not just to another world, but another clock, another calendar? I worked on my Stava grass cut. I find that curving the leaf-bearing nodes gives the necessary three-dimensionality. But my heart was not in it. Latufui sipped at tea and fumbled at stitching and pushed newspapers around until eventually she threw open the cabin door in frustration and demanded that I join her on the balcony. The rolling travel of the high train made me grip the rail for dear life, but the high plane was as sharp and fresh as if starched, and there, a long line on the horizon beyond the belching smokestack and pumping pistons of the tractor, were the palisades of X, a grey wall from one horizon to the other. Clouds hid the peaks, like a curtain lowered from the sky. Dark against the grey mountains, I saw the spires of the observatories of Kamahu. This was the Thent homeland, and I was apprehensive, for among those towers and minarets is a Hundavi, a Thent opium den, owned by the person who might be able to tell me the next part of my brother's story. A story increasingly disturbing and dark. A person who is not human.
Ida, dear friend, there is a thing I must ask you.
Anything, dear Latufui.
I must tell you, it is not a thing that can be asked softly.
My heart turned over in my chest. I knew what Latufui would ask.
Ida, have you come to this world to look for your brother?
She did me the courtesy of a direct question. No preamble, no preliminary sifting through her doubts and evidences. I owed it a direct answer.
Yes, I said. I have come to find Arthur.
I thought so.
For how long?
Since Ledec Olkoi.
Ah, I cannot say the words right. When you went to get papers and gum and returned empty-handed.
I went to see a Mr. Stafford Grimes. I had the information that he'd met my brother soon after his arrival on this world. He directed me to Mr. Okering, a retired Azjan hunter in Yez Tok.
And Kamau? Is this another link in the chain?
It is. But the Botanica is no sham. I have an obligation to my backers. You know the state of my finances as well as I, Latufui. The late Count Rathangan was a profligate man. He ran the estate into the ground.
I could wish you had trusted me. All those weeks of planning and organizing, the maps, the itineraries, the tickets, the transplanetary calls to agents and factors. I was so excited. A journey to another world. But for you, there was always something else. None of that was the whole truth. None of it was honest.
Oh, my dear Latufui.
But how could I say that I had not told her because I feared what Arthur might have become? Fears that seemed to be borne out by every ruined life that had touched his. What would I find? Did anything remain of the wild, carefree boy I remember chasing old Bunty the dog across the summer lawns of Grange Gorman? Would I recognize him? Worse,
Would he listen to me? There is a wrong to right, an old debt to be cancelled. It's a family thing. I live in your house, but not in your family, Princess Latufui said. Her words were barbed with truth. They tore me. We would not do that in Tonga. Your ways are different, and I thought I was more than a companion. Oh, my dear Latufui, I took her hands in mine. My dear, dear Latufui, you are far, far more to me than a companion. You are my life. But you of all people should understand my family. We are in another world. We are not so far from Rathangan, I think. I am seeking Arthur, and I do not know what I will find. But I promise you, what he says to me, I will tell to you everything. Now she laid her hands over mine, and there we stood, cupping hands on the balcony rail, watching the needle spires of Camahu rise from the grass spears of the Stalva. V. Volumque Fainum, Stalva Pike Grass. Another non-terrene that is finding favour in terrestrial ornamental gardens. Earth never receives sufficient sunlight for it to attain its full Stalva height. Yetten in the Stalva Thent dialect. Card, onion skin paper, corrugated paper, paint. This paper cut is unique in that it unfolds into three parts. The original in the Chester Beatty Library in Dublin is always displayed unfolded. The Mercenary's Tale. In the name of the leader of the starry skies and the ever-circling spiritual family, welcome to my Humdavi. May Apsas speak, may Gavanda sing, may the Thu impart their secrets. I understand completely that you've not come to drink, but the greeting is standard. We pride ourselves on being the most traditional Humdavi in XR Canton. Is the music annoying? No. Most terrenes find it aggravating. It's an essential part of the Humdavi experience, I'm afraid. Your brother, yeah. How could I forget him? I owe him my life. He fought like a man who hated fighting. Up on the Altiplano, when we smashed open the potteries and set the porcelain towns afire up and down the valley of the kilns, there were those who blazed with love and joy at the slaughter, and those whose faces were so dark it was as if their souls were clogged with soot. Your brother was one of those. Human expressions are hard for us to read. Your faces are wood, like masks. But I saw his face, and I knew he loathed what he did. That was what made him the best of Javrosts. I'm an old career soldier. I've seen many, many come to our band, the ones in love with violence. Unless they can take discipline, we turn them away. But when a mercenary hates what he does for his silver, there must be a greater darkness driving him. There is a thing they hate more than the violence they do. Are you sure the music is tolerable? Our harmonies and chord patterns apparently create unpleasant electrical resonance in the human brain, like small seizures. We find it most reassuring, like the rhythm of the kittening womb. Your brother came to us in the dawn of great day 6817. He could ride a grap, bivouac, cook, and was handy with both bolt and blade. We never ask questions of our Javrosts. In time they answer them all themselves. But rumours blow on the wind like Thagun down. He was a minor aristocrat, he was a gambler, he was a thief, he was a murderer, he was a seducer, he was a traitor. Nothing to disqualify him, sufficient to recommend him. In old days the Duke of Eu disputed mightily with her neighbour, the Duke of Heterton, over who rightly ruled the Altiplano and its profitable potteries. From time immemorial it had been a place beyond, independently minded and stubborn of spirit, with little respect for gods or dukes. Wars were fought down generations, laying waste to fames and fortunes, and when, in the end, the House of Eu prevailed,
The peoples of the plateau had forgotten that they ever had lords and mistresses and debts of fealty. It is a law of earth and stars alike that people should be well governed, obedient and quiet in their ways. So the Duke of Yu embarked on a campaign of civil discipline. Her House Corps had been decimated in the Porcelain Wars, so House Yu hired mercenaries, among them my former unit, Jelitz Javrosts. They speak of us still up on the plateau. We are the monsters of their great nights, the haunters of their children's dreams. We are legend. We are Jelitz Javrosts. We are the new demons. For one great day and great night we ran free. We torched the topless star shrines of Javapanda and watched them burn like chimneys. We smashed the funerary jars and trampled the bones of the illustrious dead of Turin. We overturned the houses of the holy, burned elders and kits in their homes. We lassoed rebels and dragged them behind our grappa round and round the village until all that remained was a bloody rope. We forced whole communities from their homes, driving them across the Altiplano until the snow heaped their bodies. And Arthur was at my side. We were not friends. There's too much history on this world for human and Thent ever to be that. He was my Badoon. You do not have a concept for it, let alone a word. A passionate colleague, a brother who is not related, a fellow devotee. We killed, and we killed, and we killed. And in our wake came the Duke of Yu's soldiers, restoring order, rebuilding towns, offering defence against the murderous renegades. It was all a strategy. The Duke of Yu knew the Platoniers would never love her, but she could be their saviour. Therefore, a campaign of final outrages was planned. Such vileness. We were ordered to Glehenta, a pottery town at the head of the valley of the kilns. There we would enter the Glatunas, the birthing creches, and slaughter every infant down to the last kit. We rode, Arthur at my side, and though human emotions are strange and distant to me, I knew them well enough to read the storm in his heart. Night snow was falling as we entered Glehenta, lit by 10,000 star flowers. The people locked their doors and cowered from us. Through the heart of town we rode, past the great conical kilns to the Glatunas. Matras flung themselves before our grappa. We rode them down. Arthur's face was darker than the great midnight. He broke formation and rode up to Jelit himself. I went to him. I saw words between your brother and our commander. I did not hear them. Then Arthur drew his blasket and in a single shot blew the entire top of Jelit's body to ash. In the fracas, I shot down three of our troop. Then we were racing through the glowing streets, our hooves clattering on the porcelain cobbles, the erstwhile Jelit's Javrosts behind us. And so we saved them. But the Duke of Yu had arranged it so that her ducal guard would fall upon us even as we attacked, annihilate us, and achieve two notable victories, presenting themselves as the saviours of Glehenta and destroying any evidence of their scheme. Your brother and I sprung the trap. But we did not know until leagues and months later, far from the Altiplano. At the foot of the 10,000 stairs, we parted. We thought it safer. We never saw each other again, though I heard he'd gone back up the stairs to the Pelerines. And if you do find him, please don't tell him what became of me. This is a shameful place. And I am ashamed that I've told you such dark and bloody truths about your brother, but at the end, he was honourable. He was right. That he saved the guilty, an unintended consequence. Our lives are made up of such. Certainly, we can continue outside on the Hundavi porch. I did warn you that the music was irritating to human sensibilities.
Vi Lucerna Vesperum Schefferia, the evening candle. A solitary tree of the foothills of the ex-palisades of Ishtaria. The Schefferia is noted for its many upright, luminous blossoms, which flower in Venerian Great Evening and Great Dawn. Only the blossoms are reproduced. Card, folded and cut tissue, luminous paint, not reproduced. The original is also slightly radioactive. A cog railway runs from Kamahu Terminus to the Convent of the Starry Pelerines. The Stars View Special takes pilgrims to see the stars and planets. Our carriage is small, luxurious, intricate, and ingenious in that typically Thent fashion, and terribly tedious. The track has been constructed in a helix inside Ork Mountain, so our journey consists of interminable noisy spells inside the tunnel, punctuated by brief, blinding moments of clarity as we emerge onto the open face of the mountain, not for the vertiginous. Thus, hour upon hour, we spiral our way up Mount Ork. Princess Latufui and I play endless games of moon whist, but our minds are not in it. My forebodings have darkened after my conversation with the Thent Hundavi owner in Kamahu. The princess is troubled by my anxiety. Finally, she can bear it no more. Tell me about the Blue Empress. Tell me everything. I grew up with two injunctions in case of fire. Save the dogs and the Blue Empress. For almost all my life, the jewel was a ghost stone, present but unseen, haunting Grange Gorman and the lives it held. I have a memory from earliest childhood of seeing the stone, never touching it, but I do not trust the memory. Imaginings too easily become memories, memories imaginings. We are not free in so many things, we of the landed class. Richard would inherit, Arthur would make a way in the worlds, and I would marry as well as I could, land to land. The barony of Rathangan was considered one of the most desirable in Kildare, despite Patrick's seeming determination to drag it to the bankruptcy court. A match was made, and he was charming and bold, a fine sportsman and a very handsome man. It was an equal match, snide comments from both halves of the county. The Blue Empress was part of my treasure, on the strict understanding that it would remain in the custody of my lawyers. Patrick argued, and it was there that I first got an inkling of his true character. And the wedding was off, the wedding was on, the wedding was off, the wedding was on again, and the banns posted. A viewing was arranged for his people to itemize and value the Hyde treasure. For the first time in long memory, the Blue Empress was taken from its safe and displayed to human view. Blue as the wide Atlantic it was, and as boundless and clear. You could lose yourself forever in the light inside that gem. And yes, it was the size of a thrush's egg. And then, the moment that all the stories agree on, the lights failed. Not so unusual at Grange Gorman. The same grandfather who brought back the Blue Empress installed the hydro plant, and when they came back on again, the sapphire was gone. Bays and case and everything. We called upon the honour of all present, ladies and gentlemen alike. The lights would be put out for 5 minutes, and when they were switched back on, the Blue Empress would be back in the Hyde treasury. It was not. Our people demanded we call the police. Patrick's people, mindful of their client's attraction to scandal, were less insistent. We would make a further appeal to honour. If the Blue Empress was not back by morning, then we would call the guards. Not only was the Blue Empress still missing, so was Arthur. We called the guard Ashokana. The last we heard was that Arthur had left for the inner worlds. The wedding went ahead. It would have been a greater scandal to call it off. We were two families alike in notoriety. Patrick could not let it go. He went to his grave believing that Arthur and I had conspired to keep the Blue Empress out of his hands. I have no doubt that Patrick would have found a way of forcing me to sign over possession of the gem to him and would have sold it. Wastrel. As for the Blue Empress, I feel I'm very near to Arthur now. One cannot run forever. We will meet, and the truth will be told. Then light flooded our carriage as the train emerged from the tunnel onto the final ramp, and there, before us, its spires and domes dusted with snow blown from the high peaks, was the convent of the Starry Pelerines. Vi Aquilonis Vitis Visionum, the northern littoral, or ghost vine. A common climber of the forests of the southern slopes of the Istari Altiplano, domesticated and widely grown in Thent garden terraces. Its white, trumpet-shaped flowers are attractive, but the plant is revered for its berries. When crushed, the infused liquor, known as pula, creates powerful auditory hallucinations in Venerian physiology and forms the basis of the Thent mystical Hundavi cult. In terrines, it produces a strong euphoria and a sense of omnipotence. Alkaloid-infused paper. Ida Granville Hyde used Thent ghost vine liquor to tint and infuse the paper in this cut. It is reported to be still mildly hallucinogenic. The Pilgrim's Tale. You come out onto the Belvedere, supposed to be off-limits to terrines, technically blasphemy, sacred space and all that, but the Pelerines turn a blind eye. Do excuse the cough. Ghastly, isn't it? Sounds like a bag of bloody loose change. I don't suppose the cold air does much for my tear-old alveoli, but at this stage it's all a matter of dam. That's Gloaming Peak there. You won't see it until the cloud clears. Every great evening, every great dawn, for a few earth days at a time, the cloud breaks. It goes up, oh, so much farther than you could ever imagine. You look up and up and up, and beyond it you see the stars. That's why the Pelerines came here. Such a sensible religion. The stars are gods. One star, one god. Simple. No faith, no heaven, no punishment, no sin. Just look up and wonder. The blue pearl, that's what they call our earth. I wonder if that's why they care for us, because we're descended from divinity. If only they knew. They really are very kind. Excuse me, bloody marvellous stuff, this Thent brew. I'm in no pain at all. I find it quite reassuring that I shall slip from this too rancid flesh, swaddled in a blanket of beatific thoughts and analgesic glow. They're very kind, the Pelerines, very kind. Now, look to your right there. Do you see that staircase cut into the rock, winding up, up, up? The 10,000 stairs. That's the old way to the Altiplano. Everything went up and down those steps. People, animals, goods, palanquins and stick-stick men, traders and pilgrims and armies. Your brother, I watched him go from this very Belvedere. 3 years ago, or was it five? You never really get used to the great day. Time blurs. We were tremendous friends, the way that addicts are. You wouldn't have come this far without realizing some truths about your brother. Our degradation unites us, dear thing. How we'd set the world to rights over flask after flask of this stuff. He realized the truth of this place early on. It's the way to the stars, God's waiting room, and we, this choir of shambling wrecks, wander through it, dazzled by our glimpses of the stars. But he was a dear friend, a dear, dear friend, dear Arthur. We're all darkened souls here, but he was haunted. Things done and things left undone, like the prayer book says. My father was a vicar, can you tell? Arthur never spoke completely about his time with the Javrosts. he hinted. I think he wanted to tell me very much, but was afraid of giving me his nightmares. That old saw about a problem shared being a problem halved. Damnable lie. A problem shared is a problem doubled. But I would find him up here at all times of the great day and night, watching the staircase and the caravans and stick convoys going up and down. Altiplano porcelain, he'd say, finest in all the worlds, so fine you can read the Bible through it. Every cup, every plate, every vase and bowl was portered down those stairs on the shoulders of a stickman. You know he served up on the Altiplano in the Duke of Yew's pacification. I wasn't here then, but Aggers was, and he said you could see the smoke going up, endless plumes of smoke. So thick the sky didn't clear, and the Pelerines went for a whole great day without seeing the stars. All Arthur would say about it was, "That'll make some fine china." That's what made porcelain from the Valley of the Kilns so fine. Bones. The bones of the dead ground up into powder. He would never drink from a valley cup. He said it was drinking from a skull. There's another thing about addicts. You never get rid of it. All you do is replace one addiction with another. The best you can hope for is that it's a better addiction. Some become God addicts. Some throw themselves into worthy deeds or self-improvement or fine thoughts or helping others. God help us all. Me? My lovely little vice is sloth. I really am an idle little bugger. So easy, letting the seasons slip away, slothful days and indolent nights coughing my life up one chunk at a time. For Arthur, it was the visions. Arthur saw wonders and horrors, angels and demons, hopes and fears. True visions, the things that drive men to glory or death. Visionary visions. It lay up on the Altiplano, beyond the twists and turns of the 10,000 steps. I could never comprehend what it was, but it drove him, devoured him, ate his sleep, ate his appetite, ate his body and his soul and his sanity. It was worse in the great night. Everything's worse in the great night. The snow would come swirling down the staircase, and he saw things in it. Faces, heard voices. The faces and voices of the people who had died up there on the Altiplano. He had to follow them, go up into the Valley of the Kilns, where he would ask the people to forgive him or kill him. And he went. I couldn't stop him. I didn't want to stop him. Can you understand that? I watched him from this very Belvedere. The Pelerines are not our warders. Any of us is free to leave at any time, though I've never seen anyone leave but Arthur. He left in the evening, with the lilac light catching Gloaming Peak. He never looked back, not a glance to me. I watched him climb the steps to that bend there. That's where I lost sight of him. I never saw or heard of him again. But stories come down the stairs with the stickman, and they make their way even to this little eyrie. Stories of a seer, a visionary. I look, and I imagine I see smoke rising up there on the Altiplano. It's a pity you won't be here to see the clouds break around the gloaming, or look at the stars. V. Genetric Neves, Mother of Snows. Direct translation from Thent. Ground cover high alpine of the X Palisades. The plant forms extensive carpets of thousands of minute white blossoms. The most intricate paper cut in the Botanica veneris. Each floret is 3 millimeters in diameter. Paper, ink, gouache. A high-stepping spider car took me up the 10,000 steps, past caravans of stickmen, spines bent, shoulders warped beneath brutal loads of finest porcelain. The 12 cuts of the Botanica veneris I have given to the princess, along with descriptions and botanical notes. She would not let me leave, clung to me, racked with great sobs of loss and fear. It was dangerous, a sullen land with great night coming. I could not convince her of my reason for heading up the stairs alone, for they did not convince even me. The one true reason I could not tell her. Oh, I have been despicable to her, my dearest friend, my love. But worse even than that, false. She stood watching my spider car climb the steps until a curve in the staircase took me out of her sight. Must the currency of truth always be falsehood? Now I think of her spreading her long hair out and brushing it, firmly, directly, beautifully, and the pen falls from my fingers. Igehazy is a closed city, hunched, hiding, tight. Its streets are narrow, its buildings lean toward one another, their gables so festooned with starflower that it looks like a perpetual festival. Nothing could be further from the truth. Igehazy is an angry city, aggressive and cowed, sullen. I keep my Ledbeck Teltai in my bag, but the anger is not directed at me. Though from the story I heard that the Kamahu Hundavi, my fellow humans on this world, have not graced our species, it is the anger of a country under occupation. On walls and doors the proclamations of the Duke of Yu are plastered layer upon layer. Her pennant, emblazoned with the four white hands of House Yu, flies from public buildings, the radio station mask, tower tops, and the gallows. Her javros patrol streets so narrow that their grappa can barely squeeze through them. At their passage, the citizens of Igehazy flash jagged glares, mutter altiplano oaths. And there is another sigil, an eight-petaled flower, a blue so deep it seems almost to shine. I see it stenciled hastily on walls and doors and the occupation force posters. I see it in little badges sewn to the quilted jackets of the Igehazians, and in tiny glass jars in low-set windows. In the market of Yent, I witness javrosts overturn and smash a vegetable stall that dared to offer a few poses of this blue bloom. The staff of my hotel were suspicious when they saw me working up some sketches from memory of this blue flower of descent. I explained my work and showed some photographs and asked, what was this flower? A common plant of the high altiplano, they said. It grows up under the breath of the high snow, small and tough and stubborn. Its most remarkable feature is that it blooms when no other flower does. In the dead of the great night. The Midnight Glory was one name, though it had another, newer, which entered common use since the occupation, the Blue Empress. I knew there and then that I had found Arthur. A pall of sulphurous smoke hangs permanently over the Valley of Kilns, lit with hellish tints from the glow of the kilns below. A major ceramic centre on a high, treeless plateau? How are the kilns fueled? Volcanic vents do the firing, but they turn this long defile in the flank of Mount Tuluera into a little hell of clay. Bones, smashed porcelain, sand, slag, and throat-searing sulphur. Glehenta is the last of the porcelain towns wedged into the head of the valley, where the river Idis still carries a memory of freshness and cleanliness. The pottery houses, like upturned vases, lean toward one another like companionable women. And there is the house to which my questions guided me. As my informants described, not the greatest, but perhaps the meanest, not the foremost, but perhaps the most prominent, tucked away in an alley. From its roof flies a flag, and my breath caught. Not the four white hands of you, never that. But neither the Blue Empress. The smoggy wind tugged at the hand and dagger of the hides of Grange Gorman. Swift action. To hesitate would be to falter and fail, to turn and walk away back down the Valley of the Kilns and the 10,000 steps. I rattle the ceramic chimes. From inside, a huff and a sigh. Then a voice, worn, ragged, stretched and tired, but unmistakable. Come on in. I've been expecting you.
Vi crepitant movibit volutans, Westcott's wandering star. A wind-mobile vine, native of the Ishtaria Altiplano, that grows into a tight, spherical web of vines which, in the Venerian Great Day, becomes detached from an atrophied rootstock and rolls cross-country carried on the wind. A central calyx contains woody nuts that produce a pleasant rattling sound as the wandering star is in motion. Cut paper, painted, laid and gummed. Perhaps the most intricate of the Venerian paper cuts.
The Seer's Story. Tea. I have it sent up from Camahoo when the stick men make the return trip. Proper tea, Irish breakfast. It's very hard to get the water hot enough at this altitude, but it's my little ritual. I should have asked you to bring some. I've known you were looking for me from the moment you set out from Lugaza. You think anyone can wander blithely into Glehenta? Tea. You look well. The years have been kind to you. I look like shit. Don't deny it, I know it. I have an excuse. I'm dying, you know. The liquor of the vine takes as much as it gives. And this world is hard on humans. The great days, you never completely adjust. And the climate. If it's not the thin air up here, it's the moulds and fungi and spores down there. And the ultraviolet. It dries you out, withers you up. The town healer must have frozen 20 melanomas off me. No, I'm dying. Rotten inside. A leather bag of mush and bones. But you look very well, Ida. So, Patrick shot himself. 15 years too late, says I. He could have spared all of us. Enough of that. But I'm glad you're happy. I'm glad you have someone who cares to treat you the way you should be treated. I am the merciful one, the seer, the prophet of the blue pearl, the earth man, and I am dying. I walked down that same street you walked down. I didn't ride. I walked right through the centre of town. I didn't know what to expect. Silence, a mob, stones, bullets. To walk right through and out the other side without a door opening to me. I almost did. At the very last house, the door opened and an old man came out and stood in front of me so that I could not pass. I know you, he pointed at me. You came the night of the Javros. I was certain then that I would die, and that seemed not so bad a thing to me. You were the merciful one, the one who spared our young. And he went into the house and brought me a porcelain cup of water, and I drank it down, and here I remain, the merciful one. They have decided that I am to lead them to glory, or more likely to death. It's justice, I suppose. I have visions, you see, pool of flashbacks. It works differently on terrines than sense. Oh, they're hard-headed enough not to believe in divine inspiration or any of that rubbish. They need a figurehead. The repentant mercenary is a good role, and the odd bit of mumbo-jumbo from the inside of my addled head doesn't go amiss. Is your tea all right? It's very hard to get the water hot enough this high. Have I said that before? Ignore me. The flashbacks. Did I tell you I'm dying? But it's good to see you. Oh, how long is it? And Richard? The children? And Grange Gorman? And is Ireland? Of course. What I would give for an eyeful of green, for a glimpse of summer sun, a blue sky. So I've been a con man and a lover, a soldier and an addict, and now I end my time as a revolutionary. It's surprisingly easy. The group of 7 Altiplano People's Liberation Army do the work. I release gnomic pronouncements that run like grass fire from here to Ige Hazy. I did come up with the Blue Empress motive, the midnight glory blooming in the dark under the breath of the high snows, apt. They're not the most poetic of people, these potters. We drove the Duke of Yew from the Valley of the Kilns and the Ishtar Plain. She is resisted everywhere, but she will not relinquish her claim on the Altiplano so lightly. You've been in Ige Hazy. You've seen the forces she's moving up here. Armies are mustering, and my agents report ridgibles coming through the passes in the palisades. An assault will come. The Duke has an alliance with House Shorth. Some agreement to divide the Altiplano up between them. We're outnumbered, outmaneuvered, and outsupplied, and we have nowhere to run. They'll be at each other's throats within a great day, but that's a matter of damn for us. The Duke may spare the kilns. They're the source of wealth. Matter of damn to me. I'll not see it one way or another. You should leave, Ida. Pula and local wars never get sucked into them. Ah, another flashback. They're getting briefer, but more intense. Ida, you are in danger. Leave before night. They'll attack in the night. I have to stay. The merciful one, the seer, the prophet of the blue pearl, can't abandon his people. But it was good, so good of you to come. This is a terrible place. I should never have come here. The best traps are the slowest. In you walk, through all the places and all the lives and all the years, never thinking that you're already in the trap. Then you go to turn around and it's closed behind you. Ida, go as soon as you can. Go right now. You should never have come. But, oh, how I hate the thought of dying up here on this terrible plain. To see Ireland again.
V. Volanti Musco, Altiplano Air Moss. The paper cut shows part of a symbiotic lighter-than-air creature of the Ishtaria Altiplano. The plant part consists of curtains of extremely light hanging moss that gather water from the air and low clouds. The animal part is not reproduced. Shredded paper, gum.
He came to the door of his porcelain house, leaning heavily on a stick, a handkerchief pressed to mouth and nose against the volcanic fumes. I'd tried to plead with him to leave, but whatever else he has become, he is a Hyde of Grange Gorman and stubborn as an old donkey. There is a wish for death in him, something old and strangling and relentless with the gentlest eyes. I have something for you, I said, and I gave him the box without ceremony. His eyebrows rose when he opened it. Ah, I stole the Blue Empress. I know. I had to keep it out of Patrick's hands. He would have broken and wasted it like he broke and wasted everything. Then my slow mind, so intent on saying this confession right, that I had practiced on the space crosser and in every room and in every mode of conveyance on my journey across this world, flower to flower, story to story, my middle-aged mind tripped over Arthur's 2 words. You knew. All along. You never thought that maybe Richard, maybe Father or Mammy or one of the staff had taken it. I had no doubt that it was you. For those very reasons you said, I chose to keep your secret, and I have. Arthur, Patrick is dead. Rathangan is mine. You can come home now. Ah, if it were so easy. I have a great forgiveness to ask from you, Arthur. No need. I did it freely. And you know what? I don't regret what I did. I was notorious. The Honorable Arthur Hyde, jewel thief and scoundrel. That has currency out in the worlds. It speaks reams that none of the people I used it on asked to see the jewel or the fortune I presumably had earned from selling it. Not one. Everything I have done on reputation alone. It is an achievement. No, I won't go home, Ida. Don't ask me to. Don't raise that phantom before me. Fields of green and soft Kildare mornings. I'm valued here. The people are very kind. I'm accepted. I have virtues. I'm not the minor son of Irish gentry with no land and the arse hanging out of his pants. I am the merciful one, the prophet of the blue pearl. Arthur, I want you to have the jewel. He recoiled as if I'd offered him a scorpion. I will not have it. I will not touch it. It is an ill-favoured thing. Unlucky. There are no sapphires on this world. You can never touch the blue pearl. Take it back to the place it came from. For a moment, I wondered if he was suffering from another one of those hallucinating seizures. His eyes, his voice were firm. You should go, Ida. Leave me. This is my place now. People have tremendous ideas of family, loyalty and undying love and affection, tremendous expectations and ideals that drive them across worlds to confess and receive forgiveness. Families are whatever works. Thank you for coming. I'm sorry I wasn't what you wanted me to be. I forgive you. Though, as I said, there is nothing to forgive. There. Does that make us a family now? The Duke of Yew is coming, Ida. Be away from here before that. Go. The townspeople will help you. And with a wave of his handkerchief, he turned and closed his door to me. I wrote that last over a bowl of Altiplano Mate at the Stickman's Caravanserai in Yalta, the last town in the valley of the kilns. I recalled every word, clearly and precisely. Then I had an idea, as clear and precise as my recall of that sad, unresolved conversation with Arthur. I turned to my valise of papers, took out my scissors and a sheet of the deepest indigo, and carefully, from memory, began to cut. The stickman watched curiously, then with wonder. The clean precision of the scissors, so fine and intricate, the difficulty and accuracy of the cut absorbed me entirely. Doubts fell from me. Why had I come to this world? Why had I ventured alone into this noisome valley? Why had Arthur's casual acceptance of what I'd done, the act that shaped both his life and mine, so disappointed me? What had I expected from him? Snip went the scissors. Fine curls of indigo paper fell from them onto the table. It had always been the scissors I turned to when the ways of men grew too much. It was a simple cut. I had the heart of it right away. No false starts, no new beginnings. Pure and simple. My onlookers hummed in appreciation. Then I folded the cut into my diary, gathered up my valises, and went out to the waiting spider car. The eternal cloud seemed lower today, like a storm front rolling in. Evening is coming. I write quickly. Briefly, those are no clouds. Those are the ridgeables of the Duke of Yew. The way is shut. armies are camped across the Altiplano, thousands of soldiers and Javrosts. I am trapped here. What am I to do? If I retreat to Glehenta, I will meet the same fate as Arthur and the Valley people, if they even allow me to do that. They might think that I was trying to carry a warning. I might be captured as a spy. I do not want to imagine how the Duke of Yew treats spies. I do not imagine my Tyrene identity will protect me. And the Sister of the Seer? The Blue Empress? Do I hide in Yelta and hope that they will pass me by? But how could I live with myself, knowing that I had abandoned Arthur? There is no way forward, no way back, no way around. I am an aristocrat, a minor one, but of stock. I understand the rules of class and breeding. The Duke is vastly more powerful than I, but we are of a class. I can speak with her, gentry to gentry. We can communicate as equals. I must persuade her to call off the attack. Impossible! A middle-aged Irish widow armed only with a pair of scissors? What can she do? Kill an army with gum and tissue? The death of 1,000 paper cuts? Perhaps I could buy her off, a prize beyond prize, a jewel from the stars, from their goddess itself. Arthur said that sapphires are unknown on this world, a stone beyond compare. I am writing as fast as I am thinking now. I must go and face the Duke of Yew, female to female. I am of Ireland, a citizen of no mean nation. We confront the powerful. We defeat empires. I will go to her and name myself, and I shall offer her the Blue Empress, the true Blue Empress. Beyond that, I cannot say, but I must do it, and do it now. I cannot make the driver of my spider car take me into the camp of the enemy. I have asked her to leave me and make her own way back to Yelta. I am writing this with a stub of pencil. I am alone on the high Altiplano. Above the shield wall, the cloud lair is breaking up. Enormous shafts of dazzling light spread across the high plain. Two mounted figures have broken from the line and ride toward me. I am afraid, and yet I am calm. I take the Blue Empress from its box and grasp it tight in my gloved hand. Hard to write now. No more diary. They are here. Vi Gloria Media Nocte, The Midnight Glory, or Blue Empress. Card, paper, ink.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Old Venus, edited by George R.R. Martin and Gardner Dozois. This program was directed by Fred Sanders, executive producer Janet Stark. Text copyright 2015 by George R.R. Martin and Gardner Dozois. Production copyright 2015, Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.